do to union bust or try to third party and separate people from the union, which is a common tactic that these corporations often try to do. They try to third party the union, make workers feel as though it's something that they're not a part of, they're not responsible for. And so I think a lot of things kind of aligned in our case that we were able to be victorious when it's clearly really a struggle to organize and unionize these warehouses.
We just have 10 seconds. Why did you decide to affiliate with Teamsters?
It's national organizing is too much for an independent union to do by ourselves. And if we want to have a chance of taking Amazon to the table, creating that pressure, there has to be national organizing.
I want to thank you both for being with us. The film opens this week.
This Wednesday at IFC Center in New York City and then across the country.
Steve Mang is co-director of Union. Connor Spence is president of the Amazon Labor Union, IBT Local 1. Again, happy birthday to Juan Gonzalez. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
Hi, this is Al McFarlane, host of The Conversation with Al McFarlane. You're listening to 98.3 FM, KFAI, Minneapolis. I'm Al McFarland. Welcome to The Conversation with Al McFarland. Tuesday, October 15th, 2024. Glad to be here and glad to have you along as well. As always, kudos to Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! What a great program. What great information. And it's great for us to have the chance to follow her presentation with The Conversation with Al McFarland. Today, I brought in the A-team again. Friends of mine, I call them companions, who are just people with opinions, analyses, thoughts, just consideration on issues about our humanity. I'm pleased to have with me today Dougal Youssef Mjani, an educator, communicator par excellence out of St. Paul, Jonathan Palmer, formerly the head of the Hallie Q. Brown Center in St. Paul, and Antonio Roselle. Antonio is a community organizer, an engineer, I believe, and an activist for the environment and for peace locally and globally. Brothers, thank you all for being here. Welcome to the conversation. Let's jump right in. I got two general themes, and you guys can take it where you want to. But one is, let's focus on what you're seeing, thinking, feeling, hearing about the election as Election Day nears. So, Youssef, start with you. What's your survey, your summary about where we are?
Well, in terms of the election, the lead that Harris grew shortly after Biden endorsed her and she entered the race has shrunk. And now we're in a dead heat. In the battleground states of Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Ohio, you know, she's got a one-point lead in some, he's got a two-point lead in others. And it would appear that Trump's base is calcified. They will not move under any circumstances, the MAGA folks. And Harris is reaching out. They've pulled Barack Obama and Bill Clinton out of the closet to try and rein in some Black and Latino male voters who have almost doubled in terms of their support of Trump since 2016, which is a topic deserving some lengthy conversation at another point for sure. But I think, you know, we're 3 weeks out of the election. We're 2.5 months in the race with Kamala Harris and Tim Walz. We've had the national debates. We've had the frontline specials on both the vice presidential and presidential candidates. And I have to say, Those two investigative journalism pieces were excellent. And I would encourage people who haven't seen them to look them up and plug them in. But, you know, there's sort of a feeling of uncertainty and anxiety on the ground because people are reminded of what the polls said when Hillary Clinton was running and what eventually happened, and nervous that in the final 3 weeks, you know, Trump seems to be going further and further out on the limb with the crazy conspiracy theories. Vance keeps wondering aloud at rallies why no one has attempted to assassinate Kamala Harris. Is he trying to plant seeds with people with mental health issues, or just being a cynical SOB? But there's a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of uncertainty. The only thing that is guaranteed is that the election will take place on November 5th or before, if people elect to vote by mail or go to their local election headquarters in Hennepin County, the government center in St. Paul, 90 West Plato Boulevard, just west of Health Partners on Plato and Wabasha. And there is no clear front runner at this point, to be blunt.
Antonio, what's your sense of where we are right now? What's your general survey observation?
Well, I of course I agree with Ndugu Joseph's observation about. I mean, and it's well established now. This is a dead heat in terms of if the election were to be held today. I think that, you know, it's really interesting in talking to different people that I am working with on different peace issues. One of the things that people think about and remark about is that really the foreign policy of both of the parties is indistinguishable. And both of the parties are, to say it in a blunt way, pro-genocide. Trying to outdo each other in their statements of support for decimating the population of Gaza, the population of Palestine, the population of the Middle East. And so, you know, I think if there was, it is the issue that is on the top of everybody's hearts and minds. If you go across Minnesota, I've talked to people in I do actually a lot of work in greater Minnesota. People are aware of the injustice that is being committed in their name. We supply the weapons. We provide the funding. We provide the intelligence. We provide the logistics. We provide the targeting using the satellites that we've placed into orbit that are able to pinpoint with accuracy where people are. And so
we provided, Antonio, we provided 1,000 U.S. troops yesterday.
Yes.
Programs.
That's right.
At the same time, we're saying that we're going to stop sending weapons of war if they don't increase the humanitarian aid in Gaza. So we're talking out of both sides of our mouth.
And I think it's something that, you know, even though there is a concerted effort to hide this truth in the different media that people touch on a regular basis, people know what's going on. And so how is anyone going to feel enthusiasm for voting? You know, so Vice President Harris is running as the lead, you know, providing, you know, supposedly providing a new perspective on government, and she's taking over Joe Biden's position. But her position is indistinguishable from Joe Biden's position when it comes to this genocide and to many other things as well. And so I think that that's a huge factor. Even our Minnesota representation in Congress, Amy Klobuchar, Senator Smith, you know, many, many of our Congress people, you know, with the exception of Ilhan Omar, but they're all a party to this. And so, of course, it drives participation down, it drives interest down, it drives enthusiasm down. And I think this is going to be kind of in a way what determines people's desire to be involved in this. I myself, I've made a commitment, and maybe some, and you know, it would be interesting. I know we're talking to the audience at KFAI, and we of course have all the subscribers through Insight News YouTube channel. And by the way, don't forget to like and subscribe to the YouTube channel to our listeners and viewers. So I made myself a promise. I made a commitment. I said, you know, Antonio, this year, you know, the vote is sacred, but I'm committing to not vote for anyone who is in favor of genocide. That doesn't sound all that revolutionary in a way, but then if you actually hold to that, if you actually hold to that, I think that we can't vote for any of the major party candidates. If we think that genocide is an important issue and we don't want to vote for genocidists.
Antonio, is a vote for nobody a vote for Trump?
They've been using that for so many years. I'm old enough to have heard that so many times. You got to vote for the lesser evil. You're still voting for evil. And I've decided that doesn't hold any water with me. You know, if that's who they're offering us and saying, you know, vote for evil one or evil two, I'm saying, you know what? I'm not interested. You know, let's talk about something.
I want Jonathan in because I want to comment on this.
Go ahead. Quick comment, Youssef, and then Jonathan, you come in next, okay? Go ahead, Youssef.
Well, Harris had a 6-point lead in Michigan until they included Jill Stein and Cornel West in the poll. And then her lead shrunk to 3 percentage points. It's now down to 1 percentage point. And Cornel West is on the ballot in Minnesota as well. And one of the efforts of suppression by the GOP, we saw this with Herschel Walker, we see this with Royce White, we've seen this with right-wing candidates who happen to be candidates of color for years. And one of the concerns in the Democratic Party is that Trump's victory in Michigan, Antonio, in 2016 was only by 10,000 votes. And if you add Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, the total of Trump's victory for all four states was only 80,000 votes. There are still some people of color who will go in the booth, pull the curtain, and vote for a person of color. And if the vote is for Jill Stein, if the vote is for Cornel West, we know that neither of them have the capacity to win. It's taking a vote away from Kamala Harris and giving Donald Trump an edge. Now, that may not necessarily result in Trump's victory, but as I said in my opening remarks, the number of Black and Latino men who are supporting Donald Trump has doubled from 7% to 16% since 2016. And we've got tremendous support from white females who, you know, it's not who's at the top of the ticket, it's voting blue all the way down line. We got a lot of down ballot people who need to be elected in state houses, state Senate chambers. Ours is one of the few bicameral, but 10,000 votes is not a lot. And if 10,000 people vote the way that you do in Michigan, that could give Trump those electoral votes once again, and we could see a repeat of 2016. So I support what you're saying, and I think we have to fight for peace in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Lebanon, across the planet, and in Minnesota. But we need to be careful. Sometimes victory means fewer defeats. And I think we need to be careful not to support a defeat through our efforts of conscience. So
let's bring Jonathan in. Jonathan, thanks for those comments.
Go ahead,
and I'm sure that Antonio's going to respond, and that's fine. Jonathan, good to see you, brother.
Good to see you too. And I'm going to respond too, because I have some thoughts on this. But I think the overall issue that we're dealing with is the system that we have in place. And that's what it comes down to. It is such that single issues become litmus test, and it becomes the way you decide whether somebody is good or bad or the right person or not. I agree with Antonio in terms of where the positions are. The question I think you have to ask is, is that actually what the position is for the candidate, or is that what the position is right now because of how our systems are set up? Anytime you differentiate and go in a slight direction, a whole bunch of the electorate will follow and say, this means X, Y, and Z. You start supporting the fact of people should have health care. Everybody should have health care. Suddenly you're a communist and you're a socialist and you're all on this far, far piece.
You're a Groucho Marxist.
Yes, there you go. Thank you. I think when you're looking at this, it's important not to be focused on one issue alone. The issues are important, and the ones that are priority, that's the thing that's going to make a difference. But when we look at if your only issue is Israel and Gaza and what is happening over there, and you make the decision about that, the consequence may be, and if you're willing to do that, that's up to you, but the consequence may be all of the other issues then get affected. You're talking about abortion and healthcare and women's right to body autonomy. You're talking about crime in the streets. You're talking about what kind of things we use to enforce the laws. And I think part of the problem that we have with our electoral college system and with the way our elections are set up is it becomes single issue voters. It becomes issues that become litmus tests that if you believe one thing, you are suddenly pushed off to the far. You're not allowed to have a differentiating opinion. You're not allowed to do that. So you see a lot of the candidates stay in this middle place so that they don't lose votes. But post-election, you see some of the change. And I think when you look at the candidates that we have here, we've got Kamala Harris and we've got Donald Trump. And if you look at just how many people who used to be on Trump's staff who were saying this man is a danger to everything. When you look at how, I mean, he spent the last 40 minutes of his last election dancing, putting on different songs and dancing, his last rally, stranded people out in the desert at Coachella. Ask yourself, is that the place that we want our country to be? And I think Yusuf has it right. Sometimes it's got to be, sometimes a victory is not losing, which doesn't mean that those aren't important issues, Antonio. It just means the consequences could be much more dire if we don't find a way to move the needle at least a little bit.
Jonathan, you mentioned the Electoral College. Why don't you or the three of you give us a sort of a primer on how the Electoral College works so that people understand that it's not a question of just the numerical vote, the ballots cast and counted, but there's another piece of machinery that really has an important and decisive impact on the outcome.
Well, you can't talk about the Electoral College without talking about why we have it.
Okay.
And the reason why we have it has to do with slavery. What you had here in the country was representation. When they started counting Africans as 3/5 of a person, and the representation in the southern states was upset that they had all of these people, they didn't call them people, but they were bodies and they didn't get the representation. The Electoral College got come out to give the more distribution of representation in different states based on the population of Black and brown people who were not being counted in terms of representation, but also weren't being represented.
The other interesting piece, Jonathan, is that it was the Northern political representatives who fought for 3/5 representation, because in 8 Southern states, the majority of people were Africans, okay? And they did not want the South to have disproportionate representation in Congress based on Black people, hence the compromise for Black people being and Indians being 3/5 of a human being, okay? Now, there are only two states where, in terms of the Electoral College, it's not winner take all. So if the winner in Minnesota, Hillary Clinton beat Trump by 1.5 percentage points, popular vote. So she got all of the electoral votes. Hillary Clinton had 7 million more popular votes than Donald Trump did. But Donald Trump had more than 270 electoral votes, which is the minimum requirement in terms of obtaining the presidency. So when we talk about battleground states, we're talking about Arizona, Texas, Alabama, the Carolinas. We're talking about Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, and Iowa. The difference in these states, you know, and it is said that the other states being equal in terms of the blue wall and the red wall in the South, if you don't win those battleground or swing states, you can't win the presidency. That's why all of the focus is on those battleground states to see who will win the popular vote and take the total of the electoral votes in those states.
And you have to call in redistricting, because one of the other things they've done a lot, primarily in the South, has been creating districts that are odd-shaped in order to ensure representation for conservative people within that. A lot of the states that are led by conservatives, they make key-shaped or potato shape. They make shapes that are the oddest things, but it's so that they can secure districts that are primarily red and go ahead and ensure their representation.
And the result of one lawsuit in Carolinas, the judge said even Ray Charles could see that the redistricting was intended to restrict Black voting and a Black voting bloc within that state. And they had three counties with a majority of African-American citizens and only one in the redistricting where the majority of the people who voted would be Black. So they've also limited early voting, mail-in voting, drop boxes, early registration. In North Carolina, they closed 238 early voting places, and the two that remained open were only open one day a month, okay? And the judge threw that out and said it was clearly intended to restrict Black people from getting to the polls. We're seeing it in Texas with Latino populations. We're 38 states have voter suppression legislation that has passed to limit the access to the franchise. 38 of the 50 states had 400 bills intended to suppress votes by people, okay?
I'm Al McFarland. This is The Conversation with Al McFarland. Today, we're talking about the election that's near at hand. And we're going to talk about the Middle East as well, Gaza, Israel, Palestine, and how those things connect. I'm pleased to have as a co-host today, Antonio Rozelle, who is with Minnesota Peace Action, Ndugu Yusefemjini, civic activist and counter-racist, and Jonathan Palmer, who leads Nonprofit Heroes for Hire, LLC. You know, we've got several people responding on the chat. Let me share, thank them for responding. Rita Doss says, thanks for sharing, but she seems to have a strong position in support of Trump and against the Kamala Harris. Her note here, she says about Kamala Harris, she's definitely not serious about anything. For USA Americans, she wants an open border. We don't need open border, only one straight up for our country, and that's Trump. Amazing. Well, Rita, thank you for listening and thank you for your comment. We appreciate you, and we disagree with you, but glad that we can have this conversation. Also, Roosevelt D. George says he wishes the Harris-Waltz campaign could bring together the 50 economists they've mentioned in a town hall type setting or a panel to allow these economists together to discuss and highlight the difference between a Harris-Waltz economy and a Trump-Vance economy, and allow the American people to listen and decide. Obviously, we also have Michelle Delicious Delights joining us, as she always does from the East Coast. Michelle, thank you. Thank you for the thumbs up, keeping 100. Let me invite people who are listening on KFAI to expand this conversation by letting people you know through your text messaging and your phone calls and emails that this conversation is going on right now here on KFAI and on a variety of digital platforms. We're streaming live on Facebook, also on Twitter, live on the YouTube channel for Insight News and the YouTube channel for Black Press USA. So we thank anybody and everybody who's joining us on any of those platforms. And we invite you on radio to connect with us there as well. Thanks, Hal Bitchell. She says, what a great panel today. Thanks, Al, for bringing them together. Thank you for listening. And Hal, please share, please like, and tell somebody else to get in on this conversation. And whether you agree or disagree with any of our panelists, we, number one, value you. We thank you. And we want to make sure that your voice is heard. So drop a note into the comment section. Mike V says, Vice President Harris is in a very awkward position. On the one hand, she's a sitting vice P and can't deviate from the president on Palestine. On the other hand, he says the vice president still has to campaign in the interests of our base. That, he says, is not easy. Well, Antoni, let me jump back to you. You want to respond to those concerns mentioned by Youssef and Jonathan?
Yes. And, you know, I think one of the wonderful things I appreciate about Jonathan is the subtlety with which he can explain things and explain that position and explain, you know, in the case of the argument that I was making, that sometimes you have to think about the multiple issues and think about all of the different gradations of what this candidate might do before or after the election. So I think that's a great argument, but my response is going to be that sometimes accounting for and giving room for those gradations gets you in a mess from which you cannot extricate yourself. And as proof, I offered the discussion on the Electoral College, right? I mean, here we are, mm-hmm. 200 years later, still talking about this issue that stemmed from the, in a way, the hypocrisy, the cynicism, the double standard, the falsehood of claiming that these truths are all self-evident, that all men are created equal, while we held millions and millions of people in slavery, and we killed, we genocided millions and millions of people. So when we make room for hypocrisy and falsehood, and we live with it because we say it's practical, it's what we can do right now. We don't want the ogre to come in. So we must do everything to just suck in our visceral reaction to injustice. That's what we end up with, you know? And I think I'm gonna make just one more point. You know, history is not kind and can't be kind to the people who were living in Germany during the Second World War as their country was perpetrating genocide. Mm-hmm. And history won't be kind to us as our highest political representatives spend our money to support, enable, facilitate, defend an ongoing genocide that is not new. It's been going on for decades. And so if somebody is going to ask me to overlook that and to say, you know, it's what we have. It's what we have.
Antonio, let me ask you then, use your imagination to spell out scenario A and scenario B. Scenario A is Harris wins. What happens in the first 100 days or maybe, you know, 6 months around Gaza? What are the options that she will likely present to the world and to the American people? Scenario B is what happens if Trump wins. What are the options? What are the outcomes? How does that look to you?
I think that's a wonderful question, Al. And I'm going to say that scenario A will be exactly the same as scenario B for the people of Gaza. And it's already been proven.
But what about for the people of the United States and the rest of the world as well as the people of Gaza? I don't want to look at just what's happening, though maybe we should, on the ground, specifically in Gaza. But I'm thinking about each of them represents an approach to governance and an approach to being in the world. And both of them have consequences that I think are different. Maybe they're not. What do you think?
So I could say that I know that for the other conflicts and other situations occurring in the world, like, for example, the growing tensions between the United States and China, that's primarily a Democratic Party effort that got underway during the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. So where Vice President Harris to win, I would expect that to continue as it's been continuing. Regarding the current war between Russia and Ukraine and the role that the United States has played in funding and providing weapons and exacerbating that situation, that also is mostly a Democratic Party campaign that has been going on since the early 2000s, if not earlier. And it's been accreted over time because there is a strategic desire to unravel Russia and to take access to its natural resources, et cetera. So I would expect actually that in a Vice President Harris, were she become a president, that would continue and potentially accelerate. Now, in the matter of Israel, and I want to just go back to a point that Jonathan made, and I want to be very clear about this. You know, that Jonathan said, you know, it's not so much, you know, it shouldn't be that we're just single issue on our position regarding Israel. I would say that my position is not at all about what Israel does. That's a different country. My position is about what the United States does with my tax money, with our tax money, and what it uses our resources to do. Currently, under the Democratic Party's leadership of Joseph Biden, with my Democratic senators of Minnesota, we do not seem to be able to stop sending billions and billions of dollars to Israel, to Ukraine, to continue to kill people. And, you know, there's a lot of history of Republican presidents and Democratic presidents doing the same thing for decades and decades. One of the issues, you know, and I can't remember the lady's first name, Sarah Doss, I think, who made the comment about immigration. The reason why we have gigantic waves of immigration, of immigrants illegally crossing the border and entering the United States, is because the United States did a fantastic job of destroying Central America in the 1980s. Did the most thorough job possible to destroy that. And now here we are, you know, 30 and 40 years later, reaping the consequence of destruction that we caused with the tax money of people living here in the United States. Good people like you are, like all of the people you know, like all of the Minnesotans that we know. But that money, because we elected people who we thought were the practical choice, we don't want to have the other guy win. That system is enabling this.
So in a sentence, Antonio, how would you describe the consequence, 90 days, 6 months, of Trump's election?
Living hell.
You know, they're going to be bad either way, but I also do not want to caricature the position of other Minnesotans who are supporting Trump. They are not stupid people. And, you know, that's something that I think is, it really distresses me when we have conversations that pit us as Democrats versus Republicans. And we say, oh, you know, if they're voting for Trump, they're racist, or they just don't understand their interest, or they're dumb, or they're just against everything. I think that that really does a disservice because we are not able to listen to each other.
Youssef, jump in.
I'm going to make 3 points, Antonio, and I have the utmost respect for your position. This country was founded on racist principles, okay? 12 of the first 18 presidents and 18 of the first 30 Supreme Court justices enslaved people, okay? Hundreds of the first representatives in both houses of Congress, including the first woman elected to Congress, owned slaves, okay? So when they established the policies, when they wrote the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the amendments, and established the laws that govern this country today, whose interests were they really representing? You know, I mean, I don't see a difference between either major party today in terms of carrying that banner. Okay, that's number one. Number two, Roosevelt George talked about gathering a series of 30 economists to discuss and highlight the difference between the policies of the Harris-Walz administration and what would be a Trump administration. I want to offer one example. When Donald Trump was in office, the Dow Jones average was at 19,000 points. Do you know where it is today? It's at 39,000 points, double what it was during Trump's era. And I'm not a capitalist. So when I ask you, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago, if you're a retiree, if you're a union member, if you work for an hourly wage, you're damn right you're better off under this administration than you were under the Trump administration, just based on the health of the economy. It's never been healthier in terms of job creation, in terms of wages, in terms of construction, manufacturing. So there are some clear distinctions between the two. Kamala Harris is talking about building 3 million affordable homes during her administration. We don't hear anything about affordable housing from the other side, okay? My third point supports your position, because when Barack Obama was elected, we believed the sun would no longer set, okay, that it would forever shine in the sky. The people that he appointed to monitor and assume supervision over the economy were the very people that put it in the tank during the housing crisis in 2008. And when you look at his appointees, they were no different. A lot of them came from the Bush administration. So, you know, we can be disappointed. Obama did get Affordable Health Care Act with the help of John McCain, a Republican, okay, who had the deciding vote when it was in Congress. And Donald Trump did not save the Affordable Care Act. My granddaughter said, do you know how you can tell when Donald Trump is lying? I said, how, baby? She said, his lips are moving, okay? The man told 74 lies in 45 minutes in his debate with Biden. He tried to double that in his debate with Kamala Harris, okay? And if you look at J.D. Vance and the policies and positions that he's taken and that he makes, it's dystopian in terms of the future. Now, it's easier to tell people what you're against than it is to tell people what you're for. But I think Donald Trump scares a lot of people because they don't believe that he's fit to be president, okay? The man's filed bankruptcy for everything that he's ever created. Donald Trump University, Donald Trump Foundation, Trump Towers, you know, Trump Hotel, Trump Airplane, you know, anything. He's never built anything. He sells the rights to his name, and everything that's had his name on it has crashed without exception. Everything. Okay. So what was the sister's name who said, when somebody tells you who they are, shows you who they are, believe them. I can't remember her name.
Toni Morrison. Was it Toni Morrison?
The other sister, the writer.
Right.
But, you know, and I believe that, you know, when somebody shows you and tells you and tries their damnedest to convince you of who they are, you need to believe them. Now, Donald Trump, in conclusion, has said two things of late that I think are very telling. Number one, he said, this may be the last national election in our country that white people are able to win. Okay, if that's not playing the race card, I don't know what is. The second thing he said was, if you elect me president, you'll never have to vote for president again. Okay, now this is somebody telling you who he is, telling you what his plan is. You know, he wants to be president for life, a dictator. Said on the first day he would pardon all 1,000 people who have been imprisoned for their role in the January 6th uprising in 2020. Okay. His last month in office, he pardoned anyone, regardless of their crime, who would donate $5 million to his reelection campaign. And the majority of them people are right back in prison for the same thing that put him there before he pardoned them. He was running a pardon hotline. If you've got $5 million, I've got your pardon. Call 1-800-TRUMP right away and you'll be gone today. Okay? And he meant it. Very little news coverage, very little follow-up investigative journalism. Where's the Post and the Times and everybody else in looking at that, you know, that record? So if Trump gets elected, I will forward you my new address in Cuba. Okay, because when Jesse Ventura was elected, I was in Europe and people said, where are you from? And I said, the Midwest. And they said, well, what part of the Midwest? And I said, the upper Midwest. And they say, can you be more specific? And I'd say, sure, near the Canadian border. And I'm not telling you which side, because he was a national embarrassment. Okay, you voted for that wrestler? When Trump was elected, it was an international embarrassment. Okay. And nearly every country in the world that wasn't run by a despot or a dictator said, shame on America. You know, no good can come from this man. And you know what? They were absolutely right. And another Trump presidency would be disastrous, not just for women, for seniors, for single mothers, for unemployed men, for people of color, for young people. You know, I mean, it would be disastrous. Okay, it's bad enough now with all of the fracking and the shale diving and everything else that we're doing to the environment in this country. We're now the leading producer of energy on the planet, okay, because we're exploiting the resources here in the continental United States. This man would turn national parks and public land into a free-for-all for profiteers. Now, I don't have a problem with people making a profit. I have a problem with profiteering, okay? And that's what this man's entire life has been about, okay? And I don't think that the White House ought to be a national TV series called The Apprentice, okay? Where he's firing all the good people and giving his children and his in-laws and his cronies and his donors and, you know, the people he pardons the right to plunder this country, because if you, you know, this is a man, look at his performance when COVID was discovered, okay? He ought to be in jail for saying it was a hoax, it would be gone in 2 weeks, and telling people to inject bleach into their asses, okay? I mean, who in their right mind would perform in that manner, okay, and deserve another opportunity to be the leading power figure in this country? So, I'm sorry, and I'm ashamed that part of me is voting against Donald Trump, and a small part of me is voting blue up and down the ticket to try and get people in who will be responsible, be reasonable, and not all of them. And we can't put all of our eggs in one basket, okay? Kamala Harris is not Jesus Christ. Donald Trump is not the orange Jesus orangutan. Okay, he's a wild man, and all you have to do is listen to him to see how wild and crazy guy he really is. So We need to be realistic, not practical, and we need to be forward thinking in terms of what is going to create, you know, we want to leave here having contributed to a better future than the one that we were born into. And many of us can, okay, and should. But we don't want to have our grandchildren ask us how we could allow this man to be elected and send this country down a rabbit hole. So I support you, brother, and I'm with you. And I'll contribute, and I'll donate, and I'll volunteer, and I'll march with you. But I don't want to do anything that's going to give this man the opportunity to destroy this country, and I think he would. And I'm sorry I went so long.
I'm Al McFarland. This is The Conversation with Al McFarland, the voice of Ndugu Yusefem Janey. Jonathan Palmer, let's have you react and respond. Jonathan?
Thank you. And I want to...
And before you do, we got another friend who's backstage. We'll see if he wants to join the program or not in a few minutes. But go ahead, Jonathan.
I want to go back a little bit to a couple of points that Antonio had made and just clarify. Antonio, you talked about one being single issue towards Israel and then asking you to ignore, you know, your position or your feelings around it is. That is not the case in terms of how I feel. One, it's single issue on anything. If you are single issue on any issue, be it abortion, be it, you know, healthcare, be it Israel, be it any of that, and you ignore everything else, that can be detrimental. You know, Donald Trump tomorrow said, look, I've changed my position, free abortions for everybody, and all women get to choose and do anything like that. That would not take away from who he is and what he does and his positions. It would be a ploy, and people should figure that out in order to get into power. But I think when you're looking at all of these issues, that's the piece that you've got to do. And it's hard because these issues are very important. And I respect your position. I'm not angry that you take the position or that you stay there. It is important, though, to understand, I think, and recognize the impact. You're right that our system has been messed up for a long time. From top to bottom, this country has no sense of itself. It wars amongst its people. It is built on slavery. The idea of the border crisis comes from just what you talked about, how much America had gone ahead and destroyed those countries. What is also little known is that in the Civil War, France went ahead and sent troops down into Mexico. That's what Cinco de Mayo actually celebrates. It's not the Mexican founding. It is the defeat of French who were coming in to support the Confederacy in the South. And so some of the tension that you see between U.S. and Mexico in terms of conservative has to do with the fact that Mexico supported freed slaves, stood against the Confederacy, and did efforts that went ahead and cut towards that. So when we're looking at this election, it is not that you can't have principles, not that you can't decide that this is the way you're going to go and vote because you feel this way and strongly about this issue, but recognize the impact that it may have and recognize the larger piece and that what we have seen nonstop from Donald Trump and from what he is doing, and I'm surprised that nobody is looking into the money laundering that I think is going on with all these $100 watches, $100,000 watches that he's selling and all these things that are going out that is going right into his campaign and outrageous amounts. But everything is a scam. Everything is a hustle. Everything is looking at a way to sidestep justice and fairness. And I think when you see a Kamala Harris presidency versus a Donald Trump presidency, you may see no difference. I see a world of difference. And I think we need that in order to advance on the issues that you're talking about, on the issues that are important to me, and on the issues that are important to everybody else. But we have a bigger system we have to contend with as well.
Bell Hooks was the name you were looking for earlier. Mike V put a note in. Youssef. Bell Hooks was the person to make that quote that you, but Mike also said that one thing that governors and mayors can do is stop sending law enforcement to be trained in Tel Aviv. And if you're concerned about American tax dollars are being spent, that was a note to you, Antonio. He also said that next is for local government to reduce supply chain dependency with companies involved in human rights violations in Gaza, if you're concerned about tax dollars. So, Antonio, let's pivot a little bit and talk about how and why our country is so committed. I mean, I really hear and understand why Kamala Harris says a couple of things every time she speaks. That's one, she commits to the complete support and sovereignty of Israel. And she does it in a way that says that, hell to high water, we got your back. And then she also, I think, if not in the same
breath, disheartened about Gaza.
In the same breath, she talks about being able to manage what she called the most lethal fighting force in the world. And to hear the words, I know that it's true, but to hear it spoken out catches my attention. So what is it, Antonio, if you want to take a minute and talk about our commitment to Israel? And to the Zionist state, how does that end up being in the best interest of the American people or segments of the American people? How does it work from your point of view?
Well, you know, I don't know that it's in the best interest of the American people. You know, and you know, a few decades ago, when the United States was involved in negotiations in the Middle East, and it was building up, you know, as part of its soft power, its role. Yeah. People always used to use this phrase of the United States as an honest broker between the Palestinian people and the Israeli people and governments. And, you know, I think that given the way in which the United States acted, even back then, of course, but even more so today, and kind of the immediate and unequivocal and full support for the Israeli actions in Gaza, you know, a small, tiny place about the size of St. Paul, where 2.5 million people were living and where 40,000 people have been confirmed as killed by weapons delivered by us, and where upward of 200,000 people have been killed through the weapons, but also through starvation, through demolition, through lack of access to healthcare. That phrase, honest broker, I don't think there's anybody in the world who will believe that anymore. And not only when it comes to conversations related to the Middle East, but to conversations anywhere in the world. You go and you look at the work that international organizations and places that have suffered on their own flesh, the indignities of injustice, South Africa leading the worldwide effort at the International Court of Justice, the highest court in the world, to press for a ceasefire and for the actions of Israel to be called a genocide, and for the United States to say, you know, to be stopping any of these efforts at the UN. Nobody in the world any longer believes that the United States has a role to play in the side of justice. And that's a huge damage that I don't know how the United States will recover from that, especially as we are now moving, you know, because of the growth of economies, you know, in the Far East and in Africa and in other places, and Latin America, it's a multipolar world. The United States is no longer the top dog. And it was after the end of the Second World War. The United States had more than 50% of the world's GDP at that time. And it could, you know, it was limited because the Soviet Union was a counterweight. Once the Soviet Union dissolved in the 1990s, the United States had a period where it was the sole superpower. But now its role is much, much more diminished. And for all of us as citizens of the United States living here, it is actually to our benefit to have a national government that is able to play well with others and who can be trusted and who knows how to respect other people in other nations and who does not bully. You know, I'll just say one more quick thing. Tomorrow, on Wednesday, St. Paul schools, and I think Minneapolis schools too, they have an anti-bullying day. All of the kids go to school wearing orange shirts to say how wrong it is to be a bully. And the cognitive dissonance that we must stand with to be able to tell our kids, don't be a bully, it's bad, while at the same time we are being, you know, the biggest bully in the world, and then also allowing others to bully nonstop with our resources and to destroy, eliminate, obliterate entire families with the weapons we manufacture and that we gift.
Yusuf,
the money that we raise. So,
Yusuf and Jonathan, Ta-Nehisi Coates is in the news right now. I don't know if either of you saw the interview on CBS where he's presenting sort of a story, not a defense, but a story about his new book, The Message. I have not read the book, but what I'm hearing from the conversations I've monitored is that the last chapter of the book talks about his experience visiting Palestine, visiting Gaza, I believe. And the one part that I think I heard was his description of the experience as an experience of being under obvious apartheid rule. Thoughts? He's speaking to his historical legacy family experience growing up in Jim Crow post-slave America. Apartheid is the best way to describe that. And Yusuf, what do you think? Jonathan, Antonio, we've got a few minutes all together.
Three things, Al. Number one, under apartheid, the people are severely restricted and limited, but their labor is still required. So they're not necessarily forced out. They're forced into, in South Africa, the Bantustans, okay? The black homelands where they had to go before sunset, get on the buses and leave. In the Middle East, we're looking at policies to drive people into the desert or into the Red Sea. They're not wanted at all. They want to get rid of them. They don't want to keep them and use their labor and just have them live in restricted locations. The other two things that are true about the Middle East, one, we now have a perpetual war machine the Netanyahu Zionist government has implemented, okay, in order to avoid his going to court for bribery and corruption charges and winding up in jail. The Supreme Court tried to give Donald Trump this same crutch last month when in their ruling about presidential immunity. Number two, there's no exit strategy in sight. Netanyahu has said there'll be no two-party state in his lifetime, that he won't go to the table and negotiate with Hamas or Hezbollah or any of the people who are in the current conflict with the Israeli government. So you've got a perpetual war that is 1 year and 1 week old. You've got people becoming numb to it. In addition to the 40,000 dead that Antonio mentioned, you've got 75,000 people wounded. You've got 65% of Gaza leveled, similar to what happened in the West Bank, where they are now building new settlements for Jewish refugees immigrating into the country. Do they want to build settlements in Gaza? Is that why they're dropping 500-pound bombs and leveling 14-story apartment buildings to the ground? They've dug up the streets. They've destroyed the water pressure, the water purification plant.
We got 1 minute, Yusuf. Jonathan, 30 seconds. Antonio, 30 seconds.
So I think the big issue here is that this country is awakening to a lot of these issues. I agree with Antonio on just about everything that he is saying. I disagree on when to implement. And what it is people are realizing all of these things. And that is what is allowing activism to progress and move forward. And that's what we've got to do, is look at what the bigger picture is and then step back into our activist roles.
Antonio, 30 seconds.
I just want to thank you, Al, and to thank our guest, Jonathan. It's wonderful to see you. Mr. Ndugu Joseph, always great to be on the show with you. Thank you to all our listeners, and I look forward to future conversations. Thank you very
much. Thanks to our listeners and viewers. Mike V again mentioned Turkey joining South Africa to in his position on Gaza. He also asked you, Antonio, what do you think the new Mexican president, Sheinbaum, will she throw her weight